This is the California Report podcast. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Lily Jamali. And we're going to start with breaking news about PG&E. Apparently, a group of investors, including one of the biggest names on Wall Street, Elliott Management, they have formed a group to offer a $4 billion alternative plan that would enable PG&E to avoid filing Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is it has said repeatedly that it will do tomorrow. We are awaiting that filing with the SEC.
Wow, it's a real last-minute potential save and very big news this morning.
Very big news that sent shares spiking on the order of 15%, and I was trying to figure out why that was, and we just see this report out from Bloomberg. So we're going to be monitoring the situation very closely throughout the day.
All right, and let's go to Southern California now, where Governor Gavin Newsom is taking Huntington Beach to court, and he's using a new state law to do it as he tries to pressure the wealthy Orange County city to build more housing. KQED's Guy Marzorati says more suits could follow to spur development.
Dozens of California cities are out of compliance with state housing law, meaning they don't have a plan to build the units required under regional goals. A new state law allowed Newsom to ask the attorney general to sue those cities. The first suit was filed against Huntington Beach in Orange County. Craig Castellanet, an attorney with the Public Interest Law Project, has sued Huntington Beach in the past for not building enough affordable housing.
It is very useful to have the assistance of the governor's office and the attorney general to enforce these affordable housing laws.
Republican Assemblyman Tyler Diep says Huntington Beach is being targeted because of its conservative leanings.
It is singling out a city that was on the forefront of resisting a lot of the liberal agenda that was coming out of Sacramento last year.
Huntington Beach sued the state of California over its sanctuary state immigration law last year, though legal challenges to the city's housing plans date back long before that. For the California Report, I'm Guy Marzorati.
Let's go to Oakland now, where California's U.S. Senator Kamala Harris launched her presidential campaign over the weekend, and KQED's politics editor Scott Schaefer was there. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Lily.
Why don't we start with just the fact that Oakland was the backdrop for this rally. How did Senator Harris use that in her remarks?
Well, it's her hometown, of course, and she used it to kind of fill out her biography. She talked about her parents, who were immigrants from Jamaica and from India, met at UC Berkeley, not far away. She pointed out she was born at the Kaiser Hospital nearby, and how the values of Oakland and the East Bay really shaped her as a person, and how it led her to become a lawyer and a prosecutor also right there in Alameda County.
It was just a couple of blocks from this very spot. Nearly 30 years ago, as a young district attorney, I walked into the courtroom for the first time and said the five words that would guide my life's work. Kamala Harris, for the people.
And Lily, Kamala Harris for the people, of course, is her campaign slogan as well. So a nice echo there.
Right. And we've been hearing a lot in recent days about her record as a prosecutor in Oakland, then in San Francisco as a district attorney. How is that record of being a prosecutor going to work for or maybe against her?
Well, it's very mixed. On the one hand, it enables her to talk about being a, you know, basically the top cop for California, going after transnational gangs at the border, human trafficking. It gives her credibility with those who may see an African-American woman and wonder if she's going to be tough on crime. On the other hand, on the left, some people take issue with her calling herself a progressive prosecutor. They say she wasn't really that progressive. She, really pushed for the death penalty in the sense that she defended it in court as attorney general.
Even though she doesn't agree with it.
Exactly. Theory. Yeah. And she was very slow to come out for legalizing marijuana. On the other hand, people on the right might be concerned that when she was district attorney in San Francisco and a San Francisco police officer was shot and killed, she didn't seek the death penalty for him because she had promised that she wouldn't, that she was opposed to capital punishment. So it's a very complicated mix of smart on crime, tough on crime, and it's going to, all have to come out in the wash, so to speak, and she's going to have to explain, how you can be both a prosecutor and tough on crime, but also be smart and compassionate. It's a tough kind of needle to thread.
All right. Scott Schaefer, KQED's politics editor, thank you so much, as always.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now to immigration. The Department of Homeland Security last week announced that it would begin sending some asylum seekers to wait in Mexico until their court hearings in the U.S. But tension between the governments of the two countries might have delayed the rollout of that, which was supposed to begin on Friday. Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler was at the San Ysidro-Tijuana border.
The U.S. government announced that 20 asylum seekers would be returned to Mexico on Friday, part of a pilot program to be rolled out along the entire southwest border. But after 25 asylum seekers entered the United States to be processed for asylum, no migrants were returned to Tijuana. It's unclear what exactly was happening, but Mexican officials on the ground hinted at a lack of coordination and agreement between the two nations. In a statement on Friday, a spokesman for the Mexican Foreign Ministry said his government does not agree with this unilateral measure implemented by the government of the United States. Mexico did agree to accept non-Mexican asylum seekers under certain conditions and allow them to stay in the country pending their asylum claims. Leopoldo Guerrero, Tijuana's Secretary of Government, said on Friday that a city would need help from the Mexican government to shelter and feed even more migrants in a city that has seen an unprecedented buildup of asylum seekers. I hope the government will assume the responsibility, above all with regard to resources, which is most important. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for comment. Advocates are watching to see if any asylum seekers are returned to Tijuana today. For the California Report, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in Tijuana.
All right, we're going to look at homelessness now because, Sonia, this time of year, California counties conduct what are known as point-in-time counts to figure out who's homeless and why. No count is 100% accurate, but over the years, one thing has become increasingly clear, and that is that many of the ideas that we have about homelessness are even less accurate. So one of the things we're doing on the show this week is to dig into some of the common myths about homelessness. And these are a little bit uncomfortable to tackle, but just to throw a couple of them out there, they might include associating homelessness exclusively with addiction or alcoholism, for example.
Yeah, or another big one is these people are not from around here, that homeless people are coming into the Bay Area. That's another big myth. Mm-hmm. So today we have a story from KQED's Rachel Miro, who talked to a woman who used to be homeless, who's now working for an organization called Supportive Services for Veteran Families in San Jose.
My name is Summerlee Betancourt, and I am a Home First Veterans Case Manager.
So what's a typical day like for you?
Typical day is usually I get about 15 phone calls that I need to answer first thing in the morning to provide any basic needs for my veterans. We can meet them usually where they're staying in their vehicle or in a bush, and that's where we usually do case management with them. And we usually bring them food and clothing and, you know, connect them to where they need to go.
Something that I've heard from a surprising number of people, homeless people just don't want to be housed.
That is one of the biggest myths, along with, I'm sure, a million others, that they all kind of go hand in hand. What if that was your child? What would you do? Where would you go? A lot of people, they don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. They're just confused and lost. And they need help being connected to housing first. I mean, how can you go on an interview if you can't take a shower, if you don't have clothing? So they feel lost. They just need a lot of support, compassion, and understanding.
Does it ever feel like you're pushing a boulder up a mountain?
No. At one point, being homeless myself and knowing what it's like, it's actually a breath of fresh air being able to give something back that people did for you, you know?
That was Summerlee Betancourt interviewed by KQED's Rachel Miro. And you can check out more of our homeless coverage online at kqednews.org. And Lily, have you ever driven down Lombard Street in San Francisco?
You know, I was just trying to rack my brain and see if I have. There's basically no way that I haven't, but I can't actually remember doing it.
I just remember the couple times I've done it, it's taken longer to drive down that block than any other block in the history of me driving.
And for those who don't know what Lombard Street is, it's this kind of landmark windy street that you might have seen a picture of in San Francisco. It's been featured in movies, and it's just kind of like one of those things you do when you come and visit.
It totally is, and it's beautiful. There's gardens on all sides of it. It does get really crowded, which is something that the people who own homes along Lombard Street have not been happy about for a long time. I actually a couple weeks ago accidentally ended up driving past Lombard Street, and I was just like, I'm an angry local, move out of my way. But I bring this up because the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, the SFMTA, is considering charging $10 to drive down the street to alleviate some of that traffic.
That's bold.
I know. It's a very bold move with expected controversy attached to it. The homeowners are happy about it. They think it'll, you know, bring down some of the traffic on their street. But a lot of people are saying this is a big attraction. You know, why would you?
Now, my question is, so how do you do that? Do you set up a giant toll booth, which I would imagine would only create more slowdowns there? Or can you use your Easy Pass? Like,
I wish. So there would not be a toll gate or a booth on site. You'd be able to do it all electronically. And you would actually have to reserve slots. So there would be a set number of cars per hour.
Interesting. Wow. All right. I didn't actually know it was that much of a problem in terms of congestion. In terms of congestion, because I don't live in the city anymore.
Yeah. Well, I do live in the city, and I never go over there because it's a zoo.
Well, you also wanted to talk about Scooby-Doo. Tell us all about this meme thing. That's all I can tell you, listeners, about
meme thing,
it.
Yeah. Meme. I'm going to change my title to Chief Meme Correspondent as youngest person on this team. So, Scooby-Doo, there was, I don't know if you remember, in 2002, there was a live-action Scooby-Doo. I watched it so much on VHS, I think that the tape got very close to breaking.
As a millennial, I'm just glad you know what VHS is. That makes me feel less old.
No, VHS is my staple. Like, I owned an iPod Shuffle. Don't you worry, Lily.
The woman who made quite a fuss about me using the term iPod this morning.
No, it was refreshing. It was like a nice little like bit of nostalgia for me. Like I had a hot pink iPod Shuffle that I won from my orthodontist that was like engraved on the back, and that was my pride and joy when I was in the fifth grade. So back to Scooby-Doo. There's all these fake screen caps that are going around online of this kind of behind the scenes video of the making of Scooby-Doo. Mm-hmm. And they all have fake screen grabs from the actors talking about how Shaggy is like this god, this ethereal being who inhabits the actor who plays Shaggy. And my favorite one is that the actor who plays Shaggy goes, I don't actually remember filming any scenes. Once the camera started rolling, I would black out as the spirit of Shaggy possessed my mortal body once again. Another is from Linda Cardellini, who plays Velma. And Velma, you know, very famously has terrible eyesight. Mm-hmm. And she goes, I actually didn't wear glasses before we started filming, but Shaggy's blinding aura permanently destroyed my vision. What a powerful god. Shaggy, part of the mystery gang, solving mysteries with Scooby-Doo.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing us up to speed on all the things that us non-millennials should know about what millennials are.
It's what I'm here
about.
For.
Do you ever tire of that joke?
No.
Get old. I'm sorry. It's just easy. Low-hanging fruit on a Monday. Well, thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. That is the California Report podcast for this Monday, January 28th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio, and I am Lily Jamali.
And I'm Sonia Hudson, resident millennial. Have a great Monday.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We got some things to do now. Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We need some help from you now.
Support for the California Report comes from Block Construction, a builder committed to enhancing communities in the Bay Area and Central Coast. BLACH.com, Block Construction, together building greatness. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.